Can we start back with that little prayer, please? God, please help me to set aside everything that I think I know about myself, my illness, these steps, and especially you, for a new experience with myself, my illness, these steps, and especially you. Amen.
Is that written in the book?
Is what?
That prayer in the book?
No, no, that prayer is not from the big book. That prayer probably came from Don Pritz, and I just like it. There's a group that I'm in that is not an AA meeting, but a bunch of us that just work through the book and through the book and back through the book, and we open it up with that prayer. And the reason I do like that prayer so well, and I know I've always said this, so excuse me if I sound like I'm repeating it, but the reason that I keep going back to it is it's been so hard for me. I mean, it's been the hardest thing. Because, you see, my brain thinks it figures out how this whole deal works. And I'll come to my inventory believing I know what my inventory is supposed to reveal. And if that were altogether true, now Marco said last night that in a way we know our inventory when we walk in the door, and I believe that's absolutely true. We certainly know things that are burdening us down with guilt. If we haven't lost totally our sanity, we haven't lost our ability to distinguish right and wrong. It's gotten awfully gray, you know, and ragged, and we have just about worn out that ratchet in there. You know, the first 100 times we did it, it hurt, but it stopped hurting so much. But we never lost sight of right and wrong. But it's just another form. That prayer to me helps me come to this process as a little child. See, if this were an intellectual self-help process, it wouldn't be any different from all the hundreds of other attempts to deal with alcoholism that have failed miserably. So I need to come to this like a little child with an open mind. Now, with regard to the inventory, the thing that I was told, and it's right along those lines, I do want to say this, I'd closed on the third step by saying the cherry had been so clear to me as I was walking out the door that my third step wouldn't amount to a hill of beans unless I started a fourth step at once. And I guess Cherry got his point across real well, because sure enough, about 6 or 8 months later, I started a fourth step. But you see, the idea of me taking my inventory to any effect, when I really think about it, is kind of laughable. Because all of my life, I was absolutely obsessed with what made me tick. You know, one of the myths that I think have somehow gotten into our society, and I don't know at all that it's the fault of psychiatry or psychoanalysis, that just happened to be the vehicle that the myth rode in on. But we have everyone been a victim of that myth and still have to fight it every day of our lives, or at least I do. That the whole object here is to figure out exactly what's wrong. And that's all that I need to do, is just figure out and identify exactly what's wrong, and somehow magically it won't be wrong anymore. You know, that will cure me. Just by intellectually figuring out precisely what's wrong, then it'll just evaporate. It'll just be a paper tiger, and that's wound up being total BS to me. I may have figured out what was wrong several dozen times in my drinking career, but I didn't have any solution. I didn't know what to do about it. I didn't have a blueprint. So the idea that I can effectively take my inventory, I need to get rid of that. I can't take my inventory. I already tried to do that all my life. There wasn't a more interesting subject in the world than me. I spent most of my time thinking about me and trying to figure me out. So just because I hadn't been drinking for a few months or a few years, I haven't magically been given the power to take my inventory. I can't take it. And that's fine. That's when I can come as a little child. That's when I can say, no, I can't take my inventory. But what I can do, you know, there are not but 7 pages in this book that are devoted to the fourth step, pages 64 through 70. What I can do is I can open this book up to page 64 with a pencil and a piece of paper, and with no preconceived notion of what's supposed to be down there, I can start following the instructions in this book. And I can do just exactly what the book tells me to do, whether I think it's the important thing or not, whether it looks like to me that it'll do any good to do that or not. I can follow the instructions in this book, and another one of those beautiful miracles will happen. The book will do, and God will do what I can't do. The book will take my inventory when I come to it as a little child and just follow the directions. And it'll do what I can't do for myself. My inventory will emerge from following those directions. Now, I already mentioned what a big deal my third step was going to be. Can y'all imagine what a big deal my fourth step was going to be? You know, they were going to be fighting like dogs over the movie rights to this thing, you know. Because, Lord, there wasn't a more interesting story of tragedy and good and evil and romance on the face of this earth than the story of Don Major's life. Well, turns out that the story of Don Major's life doesn't have a bit more to do with Don Major's fourth step than the intellectual admission that I'm an alcoholic has to do with my first step. Just totally unrelated to it. Fourth step's not the story of my life. The fourth step's not a journaling. It's not free association writing. The fourth step is a precise, very, very precise exercise in about 6 phases. The book tells me just precisely what I have to do, and the book tells me how to do it. Now, I like the word Cherry to death. Didn't take a whole lot to worry Cherry to death because Cherry was a great believer in the idea that there is far too much emphasis these days put on talking to one sponsor. Mm-hmm. Cherry thought the emphasis ought to be on listening to one sponsor. You know, he said, you can talk to anybody. Mm-hmm. Okay? And Cherry got it across to me pretty quickly that I needed to. Cherry and I weren't friends. We never did get to. I never even got to where I really liked Cherry. Mm-hmm. And I didn't like him a lot. And to tell you the truth, the impression of Hedge, I don't think Cherry ever liked me a whole lot. And that didn't have a thing in the world to do with it. We weren't there to like one another, and he wasn't there to counsel me about my girlfriends and my financial problems. Cherry was my guide through the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, and he never failed me one time on that. I never shared a meal with that man. I never rode in a car with him. He never called me on the telephone one single time except to return my call, and with the possible exception of my father, he's the most important man in my life. Because he responded the way he's supposed to. He was there every time that I asked for him to guide me through these steps, through this recovery program. But at any rate, to the extent that he had let me aggravate him, you see, even though it took me 6 or 8 months after he had told me that I had to do my fourth step at once if my third step was going to amount to anything, even though it took me 6 or 8 months to actually get out a pencil and a piece of paper and a big book, I was working on my fourth step. I was planning it out in my mind, you know, and thinking about it, and I was talking to my buddies about it, and every once in a while I'd reach a point where I needed to call Cherry and get a little more straight in my mind, and Cherry could be so simple-minded. I mean, sometimes he'd just frustrate me to death, as intelligent as I was at the time. He would let me rant for all 20, 30 seconds at the most. And then he'd say, Don, wait a minute. He said, you're not working on your fourth step. He said, and the reason I know you're not working on your fourth step is that it is absolutely impossible to begin a fourth step until you've got a pencil or a pen and a piece of paper and a big book open to page 64. He said, until that time, you thinking you're working on your fourth step in your head is strictly squirrel caging. And he said, not only is it not doing any good, it's confusing the situation, and it's setting things in stone maybe in your head that you'll have to overcome when you come to this step as a little child and follow these directions without any understanding or demanding any understanding of what's going on or how it's going to help. So he would just over and over again, Don, you can't start a fourth step without a pencil and a piece of paper and a big book open to page 64. And I'll tell y'all what Cherry told me. There are all sorts of guides out there for doing a fourth step, and some of them may be excellent. Some of them may be better than the big book. I don't know. But all I know is that this one works. I know that this one works for me. It has worked for me. I don't know about any of the rest of them. I don't know whether they work or whether they don't. I'm not critical of them. But I'm saying that the choice that I make is I know that this one works. And this is the one I'm going to do. Kind of like I think I mentioned last night, Cherry used to say he was going to get into all this stuff. You know, all the self-help stuff and all the treatises that are written on Alcoholics Anonymous and everything else. That he really was interested in that and was going to get into it just as soon as he mastered the big book. Well, Cherry never got the big book mastered, and I pray that I don't either. Because I think everything that I need is right in here. So I'm going to talk about the fourth step purely and simply as it is in the big book. I'm going to do something this morning that I've never done before, and I don't know whether it's going to be any help or not. Before I pass these around, let me tell you what it is. I'm not arrogant enough to think that I can improve on the big book. I truly, truly pray that I'm not, and I don't believe that I am. But over the years, the method that just developed of me working with folks I sponsored on doing an inventory always involved, after we had gotten together, usually at my office, sometimes at my home, sometimes in the back room at the Token Club over at Jeffersonville, just wherever it happened to be. And, you know, we had gone through the conclusions of 1 and 2. They had read the first 63 pages, and then we'd gotten together and confirmed those conclusions that were step 1 and 2, and then we had thought well, and the person was ready, and we'd gotten on our knees together and done the third step prayer and done our third step. Then I would sit down with them, and we would go through pages 64 through 70 in the big book, and we would write notes. And just the way it developed, what I would do, I would do the writing as we were going through. I'd say, and here, you know, what this is saying. The reason I did that, see, the first long time that I was sober and the first few dozen times that I read 64 through 70, it was some sort of essay on doing an inventory. You know, it was just some sort of general essay, and that's really what it appeared to me. I couldn't see those simple instructions in there. My brain was complicating it, making it more complicated than it was, and it was trying to figure it out. So that's the way it became that way, was an effort to just share the simplicity of, hey, that's all this is saying. You know, it says, we do this. It doesn't tell you why you're doing it. It just says, we do this. And if you do that, you're going to get the benefit of it. How this thing came into being was probably 6 or 7 years ago. I was sponsoring a guy who was in the penitentiary, which I've done several times. And by the way, I don't know whether this applies to anybody we've got here or not, but it's real, real important that we talk about it, I think. Please don't worry if you feel like that you are limited in any way in your ability to read or write. I have sponsored blind people through the fourth step. I've sponsored any number of people who couldn't read or write through the fourth step. Works just fine. When we're talking about setting it down on paper, putting it in black and white, if you truly can't do that, now if you can do it and just don't want to do it, then I suspect that doing it with a tape would not be effective. But if you truly can't do it, it has been my absolute experience that doing it on tape, because you're unable for whatever reason to write it, is just fine. just perfect. So don't worry. We were talking a little earlier today. Can you imagine God sitting on God's wonderful throne and saying, well, I can help old Marco because he can read well. It's an awful shame that old Don can't read well. I'd really like to help him, but piss on him. He can't have my grace because he can't read as well. And I love Marco better because he can read. B.S. You know, God's not that way. And God doesn't require that. So don't worry about how well you can or can't read. If you can do it with the reading and with the actual writing, try it that way. If you can't, don't worry about listening to this book on tape. This big book is on tape. It's widely available. If you can't read it, get yourself a tape of the big book and listen to it. And if you literally can't write your inventory, then get yourself a tape and dictate your inventory, and it's been my absolute experience that it'll work just fine. But at any rate, the way this thing came into being, and this is an experiment this weekend, so say I've never done this before. But about 6 or 7 years ago, I was sponsoring a guy in the penitentiary, and I got to the point where if we were in actual eyeball-to-eyeball contact, like you are with most people you sponsor, where he and I would have sat down and we would have gone through pages 60, 64, and we would have outlined it to give him, you know, a guide for going through those. And I couldn't do that with Denny because he was in the pen. So I just sat there at my desk and I just dictated what I told the folks I sponsored about four. And that one, I told my secretary, don't worry about punctuation, don't worry about anything. And my secretary is not the greatest thing in the world word-wise. He's a wonderful secretary, but, I mean, it came out just a mess, you know, just kind of run together. And I'd used it like that for years. I pretty soon stopped writing it out when I would meet with the people, would go through the very thing. Just because I'm lazy, I'd give them a copy of that messed up, all run together deal that I dictated to Denny rather than writing out the same outline. I think I gave you one time, didn't I? And you got one of the originals that was all run together and everything. And a lot of people had said that was real helpful to them, even in that form. So I didn't change a thing in it, but I just cleaned it up a little bit where I wouldn't be embarrassed about the thing. And
I'll pick up that one in case I have to expose you someday.
Okay, that'd be fine, Ed. And I'm going to, this, for whatever it is, ever it's worth, there's one there for each of you guys. Cherry made it clear to me after he finally got the point across to me that I was going to have to get a pencil and a piece of paper and a big book before I could start a fourth step. I finally got my pencil and my piece of paper and my big book, and I opened it to page 64. And the very first thing it tells me is that resentment is the number one offender. Kills more alcoholics than anything else. Lord, he talks about it bad, you know, says it's causes all forms of spiritual disease. Later on, he's going to tell us three times in one paragraph that it'll kill us. Three different ways tells us that resentment, we're not dealing with something that makes it uncomfortable for us. We're not dealing with something that makes life difficult. We're dealing with something that absolutely is physically deadly. That will kill us. And it's the very first thing they talk about. Now, when I approached my resentment list, of course, I remember I'd been working on my fourth step for several months before I approached my resentment list. I sat down with my pencil, my piece of paper, and my big book. Didn't have any resentments, Marco. Didn't have one. And really, I was kind of panicked. You know, I looked at what's number one offender. I mean, this is the main thing they talk about. And, you know, I had always suspected that my problems were far more serious than alcoholism. You know, I had always thought that alcoholism was just a result of the really big problems in my life, you know. And I was thinking, well, you know, maybe I was right to start with. You know, maybe I'm not an alcoholic. Maybe I'm just crazy, you know, without any help from alcohol. And I went to talking, and I think Cherry was out talking at a convention somewhere. I don't even think I talked to Cherry about this. The one I remember talking to is Gene Kratz that I mentioned earlier, the guy that suggested that I add to my prayer to not only not drink and drug, but not want to. And what happened was I had been reading ahead again. Remember the story about barring the jack and looking ahead and projecting? I had been reading ahead and working on my fourth step in my head, and I knew that what I eventually got around to here was ignoring the other person's fault altogether and just looking at where I was wrong. And my brain had processed all that and found out that none of my resentments were really justified or made a whole lot of sense, so my brain just kicked the computer card out and said, since it's not justified and it doesn't make any sense, you don't have them. Mm-hmm. I mean, after all, my daughter was, I guess, 12 at that time and hadn't spoken to me and didn't want to speak to me or see me for a couple of years, and believe me, the way I had destroyed that child's life and the embarrassment that I had and chaos that I had caused in that little girl's life, you'd have to be an animal to be angry at that little 12-year-old girl for not wanting to have anything to do with you at that time. I mean, yeah, I just couldn't imagine being the kind of fella that would have anger toward that little girl after everything that I had done to her because she didn't want to see me. Well, when I got that barrier out and when I began to follow the instructions instead of work it in my head, I found an entirely different thing because, you see, what Gene helped me to see is when we make, the first thing we do is we do our resentment list. See, there are three parts of a fourth step, and they are completely freestanding and not necessarily related to one another at all. There's the resentment list, there's the fear list, and there's the sexual inventory. And there are stages in each one of those three deals. And it's so clear in the book, and yet I couldn't see it. Like I say, the book was just some sort of essay on doing an inventory to me. But how I missed this, I don't know. When I'm making this list, and by the way, when I make a list, an inventory list, I do it just precisely the way it's shown on page 65, where it's italicized, I underline. Where it's not italicized, I do not underline. Where they put a colon, I put a colon. Where they don't put a colon, I don't put a colon. I still, to this day, believe that there either ought to be a colon after the cause, or there should not be colons after I'm resentful at and affects man. I believe that grammatically that is correct, but I need to follow the instructions, so it's extremely important to me that I don't improve on a thing, I don't edit a thing, that I come to it as a little child, and this is the way it's suggested it's done, this is the way I do it. You know, I put the colon where I know it doesn't belong, and I don't put one where I know it needs a colon, but I go right on and I follow it, and the important thing. And Bill makes it so clear, you know, in case you've got an idea that you can do it in your head without writing it, says, in dealing with resentments, we set them on paper. And then just in case you didn't get that, he says, we listed people, institutions, or principles with whom we were angry. Okay, what I had missed, when we make this list, there is absolutely no thought of where we may have been wrong. And just look at it. It's totally clear. We set our resentments on paper. We listed those with which we were angry. Says we were hurt. We were threatened. We were sore. We were burned up. This is our grudge list. Absolutely no reference whatsoever to where we may have been wrong, and the reason for that's real simple. It happened to me. If I jump ahead of myself, I mean, who in the world, what sense does it make to be resentful at every male who's 6 feet tall? You know, that doesn't make any damn sense. Who in the world, what kind of sense does it make to be resentful of every beautiful woman just simply because she's a beautiful woman? That doesn't make any sense. You know, why in the world should I be resentful of everybody with an Ivy League education? You know, why should I be resentful at whole cities, at whole areas of the country? You know, my brain had processed that, and those couldn't really count because they were so dumb, they were so unjustified. But when I followed the instruction, when I stopped jumping ahead, quit putting myself in a position where I wouldn't want to borrow their jack, and made my grudge list, put it down with no thought of where I might have been wrong, it began to flow. And I was resentful at every one of those people, principles, and institutions that I thought it wasn't justified, and I thought it was too silly to really be a resentment. I was burned up. I was sold. Another thing, I had tried to start from my earliest memory of resentment and work on up in my life. And Gene Kreutz got it across to me. It's right there in black and white, right after the resentment list. We went back through our lives. Folks, if I'm going to go back through my life, I got to start from now in order to go backwards. So what it tells me is that I need to deal with literally the freshest, most recent resentment first. And when I turned it around and began it that way, instead of trying to start from my earliest childhood, it's amazing how much better it flowed. That's not an accident, I don't believe any accidents in this book. It flowed so much better. It seemed like I was able to clean a space out around me, you know, get those things that were eating me up today kind of laid aside, and it just flowed so beautifully going backwards. So that was the first thing I did. I made this resentment list, put the cause, the effects, used that form exactly, and when I had done that, I had done the first thing that I was supposed to do with regard to the resentment list. Now, the guys in Nashville got it across to me that the second thing that I do does not involve writing. The second thing that I do, and if you look on, that's mainly on page 66, is that I look at that list after I've completed it, and remember, I've done it with no thought of where I may be wrong. This is done from the standpoint that these dirty SOBs have done it to me, and I haven't done a doggone thing to deserve any of this kind of treatment. These people have just done, institutions and principals have just done this to me. But it says that after I've got it, I look at that list. And this is a paragraph that I'm talking about, Acts 2 paragraphs here in the middle of 66. It says that a life that includes deep resentment leads only to futility and happiness. To the precise extent that we permit these resentments, we squander the hours that might have been worthwhile. With the alcoholic whose hope is the maintenance and growth of a spiritual experience, this business of resentment is infinitely grave. We found that it is fatal. Now, just in case you didn't get the point, he says, for when harboring such feelings, we shut ourselves off from the sunlight of the Spirit. The insanity of alcohol returns, and we drink again, and with us to drink is to die. If we were to live, we had to be free of anger. The grouch and the brainstorm were not for us. They may be the dubious luxury of normal men, but for alcoholics, these things are poison. So that next thing that we do is we look at these resentments, and we see how they are absolutely dominating our lives. Now, this may be a good time to mention, a dictionary has been one of the most useful tools in my recovery. It's been particularly useful since I already knew the definitions of almost every word in the universe. Mm-hmm. Now, when you already know what everything means, what in the world do you need with a dictionary, for goodness sakes? So for the first, I'd say, 2 years that I was sober, I would read The Grouch and the Brainstorm Were Not for Us, and I would wonder, why in the world can't I have bright ideas? Because the only definition that I knew of a brainstorm was, you know, this great bright idea coming flying in and, oh, let's do this. And it didn't seem like to me that had anything to do with anger and resentment and that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. So I finally got out a dictionary and I looked up brainstorm, even though I knew what it meant. And the bright idea is the second definition of brainstorm. The first definition of brainstorm, and I've learned later the way brainstorm was used in the 1930s popularly, is that it is a sudden, violent rage. So once I understand what the word means, that makes perfect sense. Neither the grouch, you know, the sulking, seething, carrying it with me, or flying off the handle in the sudden, violent rage are going to work for me. Neither of those two ways of handling, of expressing anger will work for me. I can't carry it with me. So it's so handy when I look at the dictionary. And this is not directly connected with the fourth step, but since we're talking about dictionaries, this is something else that has really, really had an impact on my recovery. I came when I was sober. And it seemed like every meeting I was going to, everybody I was talking to was saying, make your attitude one of gratitude, Don. Change your attitude, son. You got an attitude of gratitude, you can't get drunk. Well, how in the world am I going to change my attitude? You know, I knew exactly what attitude is. Attitude was a mindset. You know, it was my feelings and my thoughts about something and the way I looked at it. Knew just exactly what attitude was. And finally, can't remember whether it was Gene Kranz or Cherry, but one of them told me to go look up attitude in the dictionary. So I had to borrow a dictionary because I didn't need one since I knew what everything meant. and when, of course, would have lost it along with everything else even if I had needed one. But I borrowed a dictionary and I looked up attitude. And the first definition of attitude is that it's a geometric term. And what attitude means, the first definition, is angle of approach. The way that I approach something. And folks, the way I approach something doesn't have a thing in the world to do with how I feel about it or what my mindset is on it. The way my attitude towards you is the way I treat you. It isn't how I feel about you. So once I understood that, I am in perfect control of my attitude. I'm in perfect control of it. And if I approach it from gratitude, then I'm not going to drink. If I approach you by my actions in a loving way, my attitude toward you is love. And even if I'm thinking, I ain't got time to fool with this guy, you know, I want to do this, that, and the other, and God, he's kind of goofy anyway, rah, 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 that don't even count. That's not my attitude. If I treat you with love, if I treat you with understanding, if I listen to you, then my attitude towards you is love. So anyway, that's kind of off the subject, but it's real important to me is that my attitude wasn't what I thought it was at all. My attitude doesn't have a thing to do with my mindset. My attitude is the way I treat things, and I treat them by my actions, not the way I feel and think about them. But at any rate, after I've looked at this and seen that I have got to be rid of these, and we're going right back. Remember, this is the third time in this book we have run into a statement by Bill Wilson that we have got to change something, and we cannot change it on our own. This last full paragraph, or the last couple of paragraphs, you know, if we were to live, we had to be free of it. What are we going to do? Okay, it says, this was our course. We saw these resentments must be mastered, but how? We couldn't wish them away any more than alcohol. This was our course. It's going to tell us just exactly what to do. And that moves us to the third phase of the fourth step. step, or the third phase of the resentment list. We go through the people, principles, and institutions on that list. And we go through the process that is described in this book exactly of forgiveness with each item on that list. Now, see, what confused me, forgiveness kind of like attitude. I thought forgiveness was the way I felt about something. So I thought they were telling me that I couldn't go any further with my fourth step, with my resentment list, until I had felt like I had forgiven everything and everybody on that list. Folks, if I treat you with forgiveness, I have forgiven you, regardless of what I'm feeling inside myself. And if I refuse to treat you with forgiveness, I can do all the sanctimonious praying about it I want, and I can tell all my sponsors how I have forgiven you, and I have not forgiven you until I've acted forgiveness to you. And what this book is talking about tells us just precisely what we do on page 67. We look at every bottom of 66. This was our course, telling us how. And remember, we're doing this forgiving and still haven't even given a thought to what we may have done wrong. Mm-hmm. We're still dealing with our grudge list, with what these dirty SOBs have done for us. And I believe, like everything else, it's not a mistake. I think we're supposed to do the forgiveness before we start looking at our part. I think that's required of us, that it be done at that stage, that yes, it was bad, it was terrible, but I'm willing to do what I can to forgive. It tells me that I look at each one of those things and I realize that the people that wronged me were perhaps spiritually sick, and though I didn't like their symptoms, the way they disturbed me, that those folks like me were sick too. And I ask God, this is the beginning of the forgiveness prayer in the fourth step. I ask God, with regard to every item on that resentment list, to help us show them the same tolerance, pity, and patience that we would cheerfully grant a sick friend. In other words, we ask God to give us the gift of being able to treat somebody whose illness is making them do terrible things to us with the same compassion and love we'd treat them if they had cancer. You know, we ask God. Now, it doesn't say we have to get a feeling of feeling that way at this point, but we say the prayer with regard to each item on that list. And when a person has offended us, we say, he even puts it in quotation. So, you know, this book is not suggesting in general. It's telling me the precise words to say in order to accomplish the process of forgiveness here. This is a sick man. How can I be helpful to him? God, save me from being angry. Thy will be done. And once I've done that with each and every thing listed on that resentment list, I have completed the process of forgiveness. That doesn't mean I'm not to be concerned. In my case, I had begun to feel some little bit of forgiveness toward a number of the people and institutions and so on the list, but certainly not all of them. And I was sponsored that you don't need to be concerned with whether you feel like it's taken or working or not, that we need to follow the instructions and do and say the things that this book tells us to do and say, and that is the forgiveness process. Then, and only after we're forgiven, we look at the list again. Middle of page 67, it says, referring to our list again. And this is the fourth stage of doing our resentment list. And we're going to start back writing here. See, we haven't done any writing since stage one when we made the list based on that form on page 65. This time, we turn it around 180 degrees. Finally, after we have listed it in anger, seen that it controlled us and we had to get rid of it, we couldn't get rid of it on our own, but we became willing to come as a little child and follow these instructions because this was our course, the book tells us, and we've gone through the forgiveness process, then we turn it around 180 degrees and we look at this list again, and this time we don't give any consideration to what the other people have done wrong. We're turning it all the way around. And this time in phase four, we're looking only at what we have done wrong. Couldn't be clearer. putting out of our minds the wrongs others have done. We resolutely look for our own mistake, and we've got a beautiful checklist here. I mean, this is not. This doesn't mean that we write that we write essays about the resentments on these people. What it means to me is that I list across a piece of paper the word selfish, the word dishonest, the word self-seeking, the word frightened. I list, even though a situation had not been entirely my fault, where was I to blame? Because that's what that checklist in the middle of page 67 is. And this tells me that if I've turned it around, I'm looking resolutely for where I was wrong, and this is the tool I'm going to use to find out where I was wrong, is my checklist that the book gives me on page 67. And I write down, with regard to each one of the resentments that are on that list, I write down underneath selfish, dishonest, self-seeking, and frightened, I write down where I was those particular things. Now, Bill wants to make real sure that we know we write this, because he double repeats it again. He says, when we saw our faults, we listed them, we placed them before us in black and white. So he wants to make real sure we understand that we have picked the pencil back up when we get to this stage. Once we have done that, then we have completed the resentment list. We have done a big book resentment list. And we have done one-third of the third step. We're then ready to move right on to the fear list. And that begins on page 67. He talks about fear for about half a page or so, and talks about how important fear is in our lives. And, you know, remember that Cherry told me that fear was the enemy. Told me that fear would be the enemy of the right thing 99% of the time. Goes on to tell us that the whole is an evil and corroding thread that runs through every aspect of our lives. That sometimes think it ought to be classed with stealing. It seems to cause more trouble. Then the book tells us that we review our fears thoroughly. We put them on paper. So we're going to write our fear list. This is not something we do in our head. Or if we can't write, we do it with tape. We don't necessarily write as the way I've been sponsoring, the way I read the book, is all we need to do as far as writing with the fears is list them. We don't necessarily need to write any essay on those fears, but we need to list all of them. Now, I had some trouble with the fear list in that a lot of my fears were so silly that it was obvious that they didn't really belong on a fear list. And a lot of my fears were too embarrassing to put on a fear list. You know, I knew I was going to have to talk to somebody about this somewhere down the line, so I didn't particularly want to put on there the fear that my penis wasn't big enough. You know, and who in the world, when you've been a macho guy the way I'd been all my life, who in the world would think it would belong on there that you've gone through stages in your life when you have had a fear that sometime or the other you would look at a man and won't have sex with him. Lord have mercy, who'd want to put something like that down there? And you know, how silly is it to be afraid of the dark? How silly is it to be afraid? Grown man, tough as I was, afraid of vampires and werewolves and dead people, you know, and things like that. Guys, those fears that were too silly and too embarrassing to, you know, I wanted to put down fear of success, fear of failure, fear of living, fear of dying, you know, all these great things. And I'm sorry to put those on there. But if the ones that really had to be there, the ones that were too silly, that were too embarrassing, those were the fears that were really with me, that were really with me. And I had to put them, every one down there, regardless of how silly it was, regardless of how embarrassing it was. The fear list, by the way, the big book is absolutely clear. We put them on paper even though we had no resentment in connection with them. So your fear list is not necessarily related at all. You've got three completely separate sections to this fourth step. Once we have done the fear list, then the book tells us we look at it. We see how fear has controlled us. And we realize that, that God is the only, you know, the middle pages on page 68 are just full of the word God and Creator. When you glance down there, it seems like that's all you can see. Talks about faith. And it tells us, it gives us this real simple fear of prayer about three-quarters of the way down on page 68. It says that we look at those fears and we ask God to remove our fear and direct our attention to what He would have us be. That's the fear of prayer that we are told specifically that after we have reviewed these fears thoroughly and put them on paper, we say that fear of prayer. And then we get one of those little freestanding promises. At once we commence to outgrow fear. Now, in my experience, that doesn't mean that I at once feel the lifting of a great deal of fear out of my life. But it did mean that at once, immediately, as soon as I had made that list, reviewed it, and said that prayer, I had set out on the path that would lead to the outgrowing of fear to the extent that I could live not so terribly hampered by fear. Fear is still the biggest negative in my life on a daily basis. Mm-hmm. Fear is still just as much the enemy as it was 16 and a half years ago. Mm-hmm. Fear has not left my life. Mm-hmm. Fear is always with me, but fear no longer paralyzes me to the state that it did before. And I share a little something that's just real personal with me about the fear. After I was sober a couple of years, I was scared to death of so many things. You know, I was easing back into a life that I had abandoned. I would die and never have to come back to that life. You leave some pretty bad messes when you leave under those circumstances. And I was scared to death of so many things. And I spent, and also I just got such a problem with procrastination. Mm-hmm. You know, Lord, it's just, procrastination has probably caused me more pain in my life than booze and dope ever caused me. I mean, procrastination has just killed me all my life. And procrastination, fear are so intertwined with one another, I don't know how you pick that particular fly poop out of the pepper. You know, is procrastination, fear are just there. But at any rate, what I was doing a couple of years sober, I was laying around on the sofa or driving my car or wherever I was or down on my knees by my bed. And I was praying just all the time, God, please remove this fear so I can do this. God, I know I need to do it, but I'm just scared to death. Please remove this fear so I can do it. And I kept on praying, and nothing kept happening. And I didn't know what was wrong. I didn't know whether God just wasn't going to help me, or I was approaching God wrong about it, or something else. And finally, it got clear to me. What I was doing was exactly the same thing as if I were hungry, locking myself in a closet and praying for a hot dog. One wasn't going to come squirting through that keyhole. And it turned out that the appropriate daily prayer for me really isn't remove my fear and direct my attention to what will have be. Now, that's very definitely my fear prayer that I say in my inventory, because that's what the book tells me to say. Mm-hmm. But personal to me, the effective prayer that I say about fear and have been saying for the last 14 years or so isn't remove my fear. But God, please give me the strength and courage to act in spite of my fear. Mm-hmm. See, I found out that what I needed to be, I need to start the prayer on my knees with regard to my fear, and I need to finish the prayer getting up to walk toward what it is that I'm scared to death of. Mm-hmm. Because God seems to never really remove my fear until I begin to address what it is I'm afraid of. As long as I keep laying on that sofa saying, oh God, make little Donnie feel like he can do this so he can do it. I have to start trying to do it when I feel like I can't do it. I have to start trying to do it when I feel like I'm just terrified. And that's no more important than the prayer, but it's no less important for me. I need both of them. I need the prayer. And then I have to do what I can do. See, it's kind of like God knocking a drink out of my hand. God doesn't seem real interested in doing my part of things. Mm-hmm. And my part is to go ahead and start mm-hmm. walking toward that mm-hmm. thing that I'm so scared of. Mm-hmm. And then and only then does God mm-hmm. does God seem to lift my fears out of me. Well, once we've done the fear inventory, then we come to the final part of the inventory, and that is the sexual inventory. You know, if you just listen to what people talk about in discussion meetings, you'd get the impression that the resentment list was the fourth step sometimes, and you hear very little discussion about the sexual inventory in discussion meetings. And the fact is, if you removed the example on page 65, more words are devoted to the sexual inventory in this book than are devoted to the resentment list. So it's very clear that Bill intended that the sexual inventory be as big as anything in our inventory. Now, the book treats the sexual inventory a little differently than it does the other two things, because there's an awful lot of narrative there, and about a total page of that is devoted to telling us to quit making such a big deal out of sex. If you'll read what it says there, beginning bottom page 68, where it says, "Now about sex." Many of us needed an overhauling there. And he begins right in on Nobel and quit making a big deal out of it. But above all, we tried to be sensible on this question. It's so easy to get off the track. Human opinions run to extremes, absurd extremes, perhaps. One set of voices cry that sex is a lust of our lower nature, a base necessity of procreation. Then we have the voices who cry for sex and more sex, mm-hmm. who bewail the institution of marriage, who think that most of the troubles of the race are traceable to sex causes. They think we do not have enough of it, or that it isn't the right kind. They see its significance everywhere. One school would allow man no flavor for his fare, and the other would have us all on a straight pepper diet. All the world he's saying is that whichever way they make a big deal out of it, what they're doing is making a great big deal out of sex. Now, again, back to the tone that's everywhere in this book, we don't want to get in the controversy. We want to stay out of this controversy. Tells us right here, we don't have an opinion on these things, but what we do feel like is that we don't need to be going to either extreme. We need, what Bill tells us, and he just keeps over and over talking about quit making a big deal out of sex, we treat it like any other problems. Says we all have sex problems. We'd hardly be human if we didn't. See, he lets us know that every principle that applies to every other area of our life applies to sex. You know, it's just, we treat sex so different that we are inclined to do things in a sexual relationship that we wouldn't even consider doing in a business relationship or to a male friend. And it doesn't even dawn on us it's wrong, because this is a sexual relationship and we've made such a big deal out of it. On the other hand, we can cheat on our income taxes every day for 10 years and maybe occasionally say, I'll straighten that up one of these days, but nobody's perfect. We can make one little slip in the sexual area and, oh my God, I'm going to get drunk. I've ruined everything. Now, Bill's making it real clear that we need to de-emotionalize this deal. That everything that applies to every other area of our life applies to sex. Now, what are we going to do about it? See, what can we do about our sex problems? Question, and he's going to give you the precise answer of what we do. We're on page 69. We reviewed our conduct over the years past. Now, what I've taken that to mean is that I simply list every sexual situation, or they had to be for me, and there will for lots of people, that there have to be classes of sexual situation, because I certainly couldn't remember every prostitute. I couldn't remember every one-night stand that had been in my life. So a lot of them I had to do by classes. But anything that I could remember, of course, there were some prostitute situations that stood out that I remembered specifically and some one-night stands that did. But just because I can't remember specifically every one, I can categorize. That I get all those listed down on paper, and I have to remember that situations and people belong on my sexual inventory many times when there wasn't any physical sexual conduct.
Mm-hmm.
Now, one reason for that is that some of my very tackiest efforts were unsuccessful.
Really?
You know, some of the very tackiest, worst things I did, I didn't even get a feel, boy.
Really?
You know,
really?
But my behavior was there, so it belongs there.
Mm-hmm.
And once I get all those things listed down on paper, I've got another just beautiful little checklist. Mm-hmm. I don't have to sit there in a quandary about what I'm writing, write essays about that stuff. I list across my paper, middle paragraph, page 69, where had we been selfish, dishonest, inconsiderate? Who had we hurt? Did we unjustifiably arouse jealousy, suspicion, or bitterness?
Mm-hmm.
Where was I at fault?
Mm-hmm.
What should I have done instead?
Mm-hmm.
And when I take that checklist and run it out across each one of those situations, and I look at it and I answer those questions, see, I just respond to the book. That's what this fourth step is, like batting a ping pong ball back. Instead of me trying to figure it out, I'm just responding to the book. You know, I'm responding to the prompts. And when I do that, my written sexual inventory has emerged. And then this is also the most forward-looking part of the inventory, because he talks all the way through it about how we're going to shape our future sex life. There's not much forward-looking in the resentment list itself. You get to that later on. And the fear list is not as forward-looking as the sexual. It says that once we've done this writing, and the last line there is, we got this all down on paper and looked at it, so Bill wants to make sure you understand that you write your sexual inventory. Says, we tried to shape a sane and sound ideal for, in this way, we tried to shape a sane and sound ideal for our future sex life. We subject each relationship to this simple test. Is it selfish or not? Now, the way I've been sponsored and what I believed is that I need to understand that self-gratification is an extremely important component of sex. That's just simply the way sex is. And because I enjoy it and because it is important to me doesn't make it a selfish endeavor. But if I am treating the other person involved in a way that I shouldn't treat a business associate, or in the way that I shouldn't treat a family member or a friend, because I'm making such a big deal out of my desire for the sex, then it is selfish. So what I need to look at, just because I'm enjoying it, my God, doesn't mean that it's selfish. That's the nature of sex. But I need to look, am I doing something here that is so selfish that it would be wrong if I were doing it in another area? If I were treating a business associate this way, if I were disregarding a business associate's need or misleading them in the way that I'm misleading this person, would I need to change that behavior? Would it be selfish? So once I do that, that gives me a guide for every relationship that comes up. I just simply ask, is it selfish or not? And Bill, just in case we have forgotten that we're not supposed to make a big deal out of sex, it says, we remember always that our sex powers are God-given and therefore good, neither to be used lightly or selfishly, nor to be despised and loathed. Just part of life, part of what's from God, not to be treated as any bigger deal than any other part of life. Tells us God alone can judge our sex situation. You're not to date anybody for a year after you get sober now. I'm your sponsor, and that's it, by God. I don't think I've been elected God. You know, and the book tells me that God alone can judge a sex situation. Mm-hmm. I can tell you that it's been my experience that a whole lot of folks that get involved in relationships real early in sobriety have a lot of trouble with them. But for me to tell you that the rule is that you're not supposed to get in a relationship the first year, that's not my job. Mm-hmm. It tells me right here real specifically that God alone can judge another person's sex situation, and I'm not supposed to be doing it. And then, in case we have forgotten the big deal thing, Bill tells us again on the top of page 70, we realize that some people are as fanatical about sex as others are loose. We avoid hysterical thinking or advice. I mean, if Bill is trying to do anything in this book, he's trying to tell us not to make such a big deal about sex. Now, this next paragraph talks specifically about what happens if we fall short of the chosen ideal. In other words, if we mess up sexually in sobriety, what's going to happen to us? It says, does this mean we're going to get drunk? It says, some people tell us so. But this is only a half-truth. It depends on us and on our motives. If we are sorry for what we have done and have the honest desire to let God take us to better things, we believe we will be forgiven and will have learned our lesson. If we are not sorry, now here's another promise in the big book, and this is a promise that Bill repeats twice. If we are not sorry and our conduct continues to harm others, we are quite sure to drink. Quite sure to drink. Not we may drink, not we are likely to drink. We are quite sure to drink. And then he goes on to say, we are not theorizing. These are facts out of our own experience. Bill, folks, is talking about his own affairs in sobriety, is exactly what he's talking about. Because this part of the big book he wrote unaided by anybody else. By the time, after they got past page 60, Bill gave the big book back to the others and said, I'm tired of all this bickering, y'all finish it. Said, either y'all are going to finish it or I'm going to finish it. And they thought about it a while and said, Bill, you finish it. So Bill wrote this entirely on his own. So that's really important to me, that I understand, number one, it's important that if I do slip, that I don't necessarily have to get drunk. I haven't exhausted God's forgiveness. I haven't put myself beyond. See, I'll use any excuse to get drunk.
Really?
Any excuse to put myself as hopeless. But right on the other hand, it is so clear that if I've slipped, I'm going to be okay. If I'm willing to stop harming people and ask for forgiveness and be taken to better things, but if I'm not sorry, if I'm just going to keep on doing the same thing, that's going to keep on hurting people, write it off, folks, because I am quite sure to drink. Now, the next paragraph is the sex prayer, and it's a beautiful prayer. And, Lord, this thing, it's just, like everything in this book, I think it's divinely perfect. You know, Bill says that all he did in writing this book was hold a pencil. And when you think that nobody involved in writing this book had been sober as long as 3 years, there's no way in this world that those human beings could have produced this thing. The sex prayer. To sum up about sex, we pray for the right ideal. And how much do we need the right ideal? Lord, when I got sober, I had no idea. Didn't know whether I was supposed to have sex with people I wasn't married to or not. I didn't know whether I could date and have casual sex with more than one person. I didn't know whether I ought to have a young woman, an old woman, or an educated woman, or an uneducated woman, a woman in AA, or a woman that wasn't in AA. I didn't have any idea what the right ideal was. For guidance in each questionable situation. How many of us have ever needed that? For sanity. You ever need that in sexual areas? And for the strength to do the right thing. Beautiful, beautiful sex prayer. And there have been long periods in my life when I prayed that along with my prayers every morning in my life. And then it goes on to tell us sex is just like everything else. If it's real troublesome, we throw ourselves the harder into helping others. We think of their needs and work for them. This takes us out of ourselves. It quiets the imperious urge. That got me into the dictionary again, by the way, and imperious means overwhelming or commanding, when to yield would mean heartache. So I treat sex exactly like it would everything else. And once I've done that, fellas, I have completed my sexual inventory, and I have completed a big book fourth step. Nothing left for me to do on the inventory at that stage. Anybody got any comments or anything before we break it until after supper tonight?